Chapter 25. After the children's bumps and bruises caused from being knocked around during the fight with the Red Fokker and its unknown pilot were tended to by paramedics, they were reunited with their parents. Pitt stood by a grief-stricken Kelly as the body of her friend Mary Conroe was carried from the plane to an ambulance. After the police cordoned off the airplane, Pitt and Kelly were escorted to police cars to be taken to the nearest precinct for questioning. Before he was let off, Pitt walked around the old Ford Trimotor, amazed and saddened at the amount of punishment she had endured. Yet she had miraculously hung in the air until he set her down safely in the sheep meadow. He studied the bullet-ripped tail section, the neatly stitched holes in the upper wings, the shattered cylinder heads on the two Pratt and Whitney engines, still crackling from the heat and emitting light swirls of smoke. He laid a hand on the fender over a landing wheel and murmured, "Thank you." Then he asked the police officer in charge if they might stop by the wreckage of the Fokker before heading for the precinct. The officer nodded and motioned to the closest police car. The Red Fokker looked like a crumpled kite as it lay embedded in a huge elm tree 20 feet off the ground. Firemen working from a ladder on a fire truck were standing under the wreckage, staring up at the mangled plane. Pitt exited the police car and walked under the plane. He stopped and stared at the engine that had been torn from its mountings and was lying partially embedded in the grass. He was surprised to find it wasn't an updated modern engine, but an original Oberursel 9-cylinder that put out 110 horsepower. Then he stared up into the open cockpit. It was empty. Pitt looked into the branches of the tree and then studied the ground beneath the plane. A leather flying jacket, along with a helmet and goggles, its lenses smeared with streaks of blood, were the only trace of the pilot. Almost miraculously, he had vanished. While Kelly was being interrogated by police officers, Pitt was allowed to call a local aircraft maintenance company and arrange for the trimotor to be disassembled and trucked back to Washington, where he would have it repaired and reconstructed to her previous pristine condition by aircraft restoration experts. Then he called Sandecker and reported on the situation. His calls made, Pitt calmly sat at an empty desk in the precinct and worked on the New York Times crossword puzzle until he was called. He and Kelly embraced as she left the office where four detectives were waiting at a scarred oak desk that showed its age by the number of old cigarette burn marks on its surface. "Mr. Pitt," asked a small man with a thin mustache. The detective was coatless and wore narrow suspenders. "That's my name. I'm Inspector Mark Hacken. My fellow detectives and I would like to ask you a few questions. Do you mind if we record the session?"
"Not at all."
Hacken made no offer to introduce the other three men in the room. None looked like the police as depicted on TV. They all appeared like ordinary neighbors who mowed their lawns every Saturday. Hacken began by asking Pitt to talk about himself briefly, explain his job at NUMA, and tell how he came to bring his old aircraft to the Disabled Children's Airshow benefit. The other detectives asked an occasional question, but mostly took notes as Pitt described the flight from the moment he'd taken off with the disabled children from Jean Taylor Field until he'd landed on the sheep meadow in Central Park. One of the detectives looked at Pitt and said, "I'm a pilot myself, and I hope you realize you could go to jail for your antics, not to mention losing your pilot's license." Pitt gazed at the detective with a faint trace of a confident grin. "If saving the lives of 15 disabled children makes me a criminal, so be it."
"You still might have accomplished that by not turning off the river and into the city streets."
"If I had not turned onto Wall Street when I did, we would have surely been shot down and crashed in the river. Trust me when I say there would have been no survivors."
"But you must admit you took a terrible chance."
Pitt shrugged indifferently. "Obviously, I wouldn't be sitting here if I hadn't taken the gamble."
Do you have any idea why the other pilot would risk a $1 million aircraft, load it with antique operational weapons, and attack an old plane full of disabled kids? Asked Hacken.
I only wish I knew, said Pitt, sneaking past the question.
So do I, said Hacken sarcastically.
Do you have any idea who the pilot was? Pitt asked in return.
Not a clue. He melted into the crowd and escaped.
The aircraft has to have a registration number that would lead to the owner.
Our experts haven't had a chance to examine the plane yet.
Surely the airshow officials have his entry papers, said Pitt. We all had to fill them out for insurance purposes. They should tell you something.
We're working with New Jersey law enforcement from that end. All they can tell us until they are further into the investigation was that an aircraft collector called and said an identical plane was hangared at a small field near Pittsburgh. He claimed the owner was one Raoul St. Justin.
Sounds phony, offered Pitt.
We agree, said Hacken. Did you know St. Justin, or whatever his true name is?
No.
Pitt stared steadily into Hacken's eyes.
We talked briefly before I took off.
What did you talk about?
His triplane. I've always been fascinated by antique aircraft. Nothing more.
Then you had never met him previously?
No.
Can you give a description and assist our crime artist in making a likeness of his face?
I'll be happy to cooperate.
We're sorry to have to put you and Miss Egan through this, but with the death of Mary Conroe, we're looking at a murder investigation, as well as charges of endangering public lives. It was a miracle no one was killed when the red airplane strafed you in the city streets and our police helicopter was shot down near a busy intersection.
We can all be thankful for that, said Pitt sincerely.
I think that will be all for now, said Hacken. You and Miss Egan will, of course, have to remain in the city until our investigation is concluded.
I'm afraid that is impossible, Inspector.
Hacken's eyebrows rose. He wasn't used to having a witness in a prominent case tell him he was leaving town.
May I hear why?
Because I'm a part of the ongoing government investigation into the fire on board the cruise ship Emerald Dolphin, as well as the hijacking of a NUMA survey ship. My presence is required in Washington.
Pitt paused for effect.
Naturally, you'll want to clear this with my superior, Admiral Sandecker of the National Underwater and Marine Agency. He pulled out his wallet and handed Hacken his NUMA card. Here is his phone number.
Hacken silently passed the card to one of his detectives, who left the room.
Are you through with me?
I'd like to take Miss Egan home.
Hacken nodded and gestured toward the door.
Please wait outside until we confirm your connection with the government and the investigation.
Pitt found Kelly sitting curled up on a wooden bench. She looked like a pathetic little girl left on the steps of an orphanage.
Are you all right?
I can't get over Mary's death, she said sadly. She was a close friend of my father's for many years.
Pitt's eyes strayed across the busy precinct office to see if anyone was listening to their conversation. Satisfied that no one was within earshot, he asked,
"Just how close was Mary to your father?"
She looked at him angrily. "They were lovers over the years, if that's what you want to hear."
"That's not what I want to hear," Pitt said softly.
How knowledgeable was she about your father's projects?
She was no stranger to them. Because I had my own career and was away most of the time, she acted as his close confidant, secretary, maid, and housekeeper when she wasn't flying with the airlines.
Did he ever talk to you about his work?
She shook her head.
Dad was a very secretive man. He always said that explaining his work to anyone other than a scientist or engineer would be impossible. The only time he lectured me on his work was on board the Emerald Dolphin. He was quite proud of his engineering concepts for the ship's engines, and he explained their magnetohydrodynamics principle to me over dinner one night. That's all he ever told you. After a few martinis in the lounge, he did say that he had created the breakthrough of the ages. Kelly shrugged wistfully. I thought it was the gin talking. Then Mary was the only person aware of his activities. No. She looked up as if seeing someone. Josh Thomas. Who? Dr. Josh Thomas was my father's friend and sometimes his assistant. They went to MIT together and received their doctorates, Dad in engineering and Josh in chemistry. Do you know where you can get in touch with him? Yes, she answered. Where is your father's laboratory? Pitt asked. At his home, not far from Taylor Field. Can you call Dr. Thomas? I would like to meet him. Any particular reason? You might say I'm dying to find out what the breakthrough of the ages is all about.